Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up tonight. First, in a little while, we'll speak with two folks about the issue of eminent domain. First, New York City Council member Letitia James, who has been very active in fighting the Bruce Ratner Atlantic Yards project in Brooklyn, and which is a project that could not go forward without the state's power to condemn property and seize it on behalf of a private developer. And then we'll also be joined by Dana Berliner, who is a lawyer with the Institute for Justice, which is a kind of libertarian public interest law firm that has been in the forefront of the fight against eminent domain. Sadly, the right wing has taken ownership of this issue when it shouldn't be. The use of state power to enrich private developers is something that all right-thinking people should condemn. And we will talk to Dana Berliner also, maybe to give more of a national perspective. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Heidi Scherholz of the Economic Policy Institute, who will talk about EPI's plan to create lots of jobs. The economic crisis not going away of its own accord, and it could use a lot of help from the public sector to turn things around. And EPI has a five-point plan on how to get the economy going again and create lots and lots of jobs. Looks like the economy may be stabilizing, but the labor market has yet to hear that news. All right, some comments on the economic news. Two stories on the front of Thursday's Financial Times tell you a lot about life in today's USA. Above the fold, a phrase that probably doesn't mean all that much to anyone under the age of 35, the lead story tells us that the Bank of America is about to pay back the $45 billion the U.S. government lent to it when it was on the verge of collapse last year. Bank of America finds all those pay restrictions and other government supervision just too onerous and can't wait to get out from under that yoke. About two-thirds of the $45 billion will come from the bank's healthy stream of profits, and the balance will come from the sale of new stock to the public. The price of the stock rose in the news, suggesting healthy appetites for security that wasn't desirable even with the intervention of the proverbial 10-foot pole as recently as March, when you could buy a share for just $2.50, not much more than you pay for a cash withdrawal at an ATM. Now the stock is trading at over six times that price. What remarkable powers of resilience. What this means, among other things, is the government bailout worked, in some sense. That is, throwing hundreds of billions of dollars at the financial system kept things from going totally down the drain. Still, the unemployment rate is over 10%, jobs continue to disappear, and nothing serious has been done to prevent future crises of this magnitude. The Bush-Obama scheme to restore the status quo ante has been pretty successful on its own terms. Further proof of that can be seen in the failure of the markets to begin a fresh journey towards oblivion with last week's news of Dubai's debt default. I noticed that some of the more fevered corners of the internet commentariat were convinced that this week's trading would bring a relapse of last year's crisis, but that hasn't happened. I'd never say that a relapse is impossible, but it does look like we've moved on to a new phase of the melodrama, financial stabilization followed by some kind of economic recovery. I still expect the recovery to stink, but Armageddon has at least been postponed. Plus ça change. The other telling story on the front of Thursday's FT reported in a study by the FDIC, an entity rendered nearly bankrupt by rescuing failed banks over the last year. The study shows that 17 million adult Americans live without bank accounts, and another 43 million are underbanked, as they say, using pawn shops, payday lenders, check cashing joints, and other shady operators to handle many of their financial transactions. The latter gang charge enormous fees and interest rates, making straight bankers, who aren't shy about their fees and interest rates, look like pikers in comparison. The FDIC found huge racial disparities in underbankitude, with 3% of white households lacking bank accounts, but 22% of black households so deprived, seven times as many. So big finance thrives while regular folks are squeezed. A serious financial reform would squeeze the financiers and force bankers to provide basic financial services at reasonable prices to everyone. But there's nothing like serious financial reform on the horizon. In a lot of ways, Barack Obama is the best friend that Wall Street ever had. It's one thing to coddle bankers in good times. It's another entirely to give them a blank check to enable them to go back to making the mischief that got us in trouble in the first place. Speaking of mischief, trouble in first places, Fed Chair Bernanke's renomination is making its way through the Senate. Some senators, like Connecticut's Chris Dodd, facing a tough re-election campaign in a state that is headquarters to much of the hedge fund and insurance industries, made a show of tongue-lashing Bernanke, but I bet he ends up voting for his confirmation anyway. Bernie Sanders is using a parliamentary technique that will require Bernanke's confirmation to get 60 instead of the usual 51 votes to pass, but I'll bet he'll get all 60. Why is this guy getting reappointed? He let the bubble inflate, dismissed worries about the danger of subprime mortgages and derivatives, said in mid-2008 that the recession was unlikely to get too serious, just as it was about to get very serious, and then, when everything fell apart, set about writing big, 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 giant, big checks to Wall Street. Yes, in a financial crisis, it's essential that a central bank flood the system with money to keep things from imploding utterly. But Bernanke has done so without any clear strategy or accountability and absolutely no commitment to ensuring that it doesn't happen again. Truly, the American ruling class is a rotting social formation. And now an update specifically for the KPFA and podcast audiences. On Friday morning, we got the employment report for the month of November. It was something of a pleasant surprise. I've been expecting job losses of around 150,000 and no change in the unemployment rate. What we got instead was a decline of 11,000 in employment and a 0.2-point decline in the unemployment rate. Of course, the report was still mildly negative, not robustly positive, but as they say, flat is the new up. Most of the job losses were in goods production, meaning manufacturing and construction. But the housing bus looks to be running its course, with most of the losses in construction coming from the non-residential sector. The commercial real estate bust, part two of the whole real estate disaster, is really biting now. Private services gained 51,000, the sector's best performance since the recession began in December 2007. Most of that rise came from increases in temp employment and in health care. Health care is almost always up, and most temp jobs aren't the stuff of dreams, but over the long term, temp has led broader employment trends both up and down. Most other service sectors showed small losses. The average hourly wage was up only a hair and was unchanged in the service sector. With the job market as weak as it is, it's no surprise that wage growth is almost non-existent. But the average work week rose a decent 0.2 hours. Since movements in the length of the work week, like movements in temp employment, often presage broader employment trends, this too is encouraging news for the future. Aside from the unemployment rate, the stats I've been quoting come from the monthly survey of about 300,000 employers. The survey of 60,000 households done at the same time as the employer survey showed mixed results. As I said, the unemployment rate fell 0.2 points, its biggest decline in 4 years. At 10%, it's still very high, and it's quite likely will rise again in the coming months, but this is one of the better bits of economic news we've gotten in a long time. The broadest measure of unemployment, the so-called U6 rate, which adds to the official measure those who are working part-time, though they'd prefer full-time work, and also those who have given up the job search as hopeless, fell 0.3 points. It's still an astronomical and disastrous 17.2%, but at least it's heading in the right direction. As I've been saying here for a long time, the savage declines in employment over the last couple of years have been driven more by an extreme reluctance on the part of employers to hire rather than a very high rate of job loss. Friday's report contained only the slightest hint that this trend is about to change. The probability of a person unemployed in October finding a job in November rose some over the previous month, but is still quite low, and below the levels even of earlier this year when the economy was bleeding jobs. But the rate of job loss did ebb between October and November to the lowest level we've seen in a year and a half. I should say that I borrowed the techniques for making these estimates of both the probability of finding a job and for the rate of job loss from the economist Robert Shimer. Nothing in the November jobs report would lead me to change my expectation for only a weak and slow recovery in employment in the coming months. This looks more like the end of the recession than the beginning of a strong recovery. Still, you take encouragement where you can find it, and there's some encouragement to find here. Not much, but some. What would be scary, though, is if the authorities and their associated pundits concluded from November's employment report that, in the words of Julian of Norwich, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. I'd always thought that phrase originated with T.S. Eliot, but a little Googling set me straight. Later in this show, we'll hear from Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute about their ambitious jobs program. We still need something like that, even if the labor market is beginning to heal. The economy is facing too many headwinds, and too many people are still suffering, not to treat the current level of unemployment as anything but a social emergency. Calls to cut spending and raise interest rates are getting louder every week. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke was before the Senate just the other day urging Congress to cut Medicare and Social Security. I suspect that the upper reaches of American society are deeply interested in imposing an austerity program on most of us in order to pay the bills for the bailout and stimulus programs. It's never too early to gear up for that fight. And finally, in non-economic news, I see that the process of liberal disillusionment with Obama is well underway. Let me quote something I wrote for my newsletter, Left Business Observer, back in March 2008, just as Obama's stock was really taking off. Quote, "As this newsletter has argued for years, there's great political potential in popular disillusionment with the Democrats. This phenomenon was first diagnosed by Gary Wills in Nixon Agonistes. As Wills explained it, throughout the 1950s, left liberal intellectuals thought that the national malaise was the fault of Eisenhower and a Democrat would cure it. Well, they got JFK and everything still pretty much sucked, and this is what gave rise to the rebellions of the 1960s and all that excess that Obama said he wants to junk any remnant of. You could argue that the movements of the 1990s that culminated in Seattle were a minor rerun of this, that is, in response to the disappointment of Clintonism. The sense of malaise and alienation is probably stronger now than it was 50 years ago, and includes a lot more of the working class, whom Stanley Greenberg's focus groups find to be really pissed off about the cost of living and the way the rich are really lording it over the rest of us." And that's the end of the quote. By the way, I searched the FCC's website to see if it's okay to use the phrase pissed off on the air. According to a 2002 ruling, it is, because it's a slang term for angry with and doesn't refer to an excretory function, and I'm not using it to pander or to titillate, so I'm in the clear. Back to the analysis. In one of those historical ironies, I now see that none other than Gary Wills himself, the very writer from whom I borrowed the notion of productive disillusionment with the Democrats, wrote in the New York Review of Books website the other day that he's had it with Obama. The escalation in Afghanistan was the final straw. Onward to mass radicalization. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about eminent domain.
Colors looking so neat with compulsory purchase, we can buy it up cheap.
Then we'll pull up the floorboards, tear down the walls, rock the foundations until the house falls.
Like a pack of cards crashing to the ground.
Then we'll build a row of identical boxes and sell them all off at treble the profits.
Now some of the Kinks song Demolition from their album Preservation Act 1 with compulsory purchase, and we'll knock them all down and build identical boxes and treble the profits. Perfect setup for this segment on eminent domain, which was the power of the state to seize property. It was once confined to what was legitimate public use, or what was considered legitimate public use, but has expanded over the decades to include the use of the state power to seize houses and businesses in order to promote private interest, private development. And we have that in Brooklyn going on, also a lot of Harlem around Columbia University in New York, and New York with one of the most developer-friendly eminent domain regimes in the country. We're now joined by Letitia James, who is a council member, who has been a New York City council member, who has been very active in fighting Bruce Ratner's Atlantic Yards project, and also Dana Berliner, who is a lawyer with the Institute for Justice, which has been litigating eminent domain issues around the country. Welcome to both of you. Tish James, let's start by talking about the Atlantic Yards project. I think probably a lot of the listeners know what it's all about, but just give us, you know, what does Bruce Ratner want to do with the project, and what is the state doing to help him?
Well, the project was proposed about 6 years ago, the same about a week after that I was elected into the city council. It involves a 20,000-seat arena to the New Jersey Nets, which, as you know, is just won a record of being having lost more games than any other team in the history of the NBA. They also want to build 16 tall buildings, skyscrapers in a brownstone community, primarily at Flatbush on Atlantic, which is the crossroads of Brooklyn. Recently, there was a Court of Appeals decision which basically ruled in their favor, which basically indicated that the area was quote-unquote blighted, and that they could begin condemnation proceedings to begin this project. They cannot build this project in the absence of exercising eminent domain, which I believe is an abuse of eminent domain.
Which is the right just to, like, seize people's houses and businesses and kick them out.
It's a significant number of private homes, private businesses that are in the Atlantic Yards footprint. And so basically they want to seize it, not because this is a public project. In my humble opinion, this is a private project. It would inure to the benefit of Forest City Ratner and his investors. It would build a 20,000-seat arena for the New Jersey Nets, a private enterprise. It would exact ticket prices where the vast majority of the residents that I represent in the city council cannot afford. It would build luxury housing. Yes, it would build some affordable housing, but at this point in time, there is no commitment to build the affordable housing. There is minimal amount of open space and public space in this project. But as of right now, because of the economy in the city of New York, the plan right now is just to build the arena, 20,000-seat arena. And the mayor of the city of New York, Mayor Bloomberg, will provide an additional $100 million of your tax dollars to finance this private project. There was a recent decision which just came out today where some homeowners uptown at Columbia University basically won a court ruling where that court, the first department, indicated in a 3-2 ruling, the appellate division said that it would be unconstitutional to use eminent domain to benefit a private elite education institution. And so my question really is why the differences in the two decisions. I'm hoping that we can re-argue our case before the Court of Appeals. And I'm hoping that we ultimately, I'm confident that we ultimately will be successful. We have 3 more lawsuits and more to come, and we will not stand silent in the face of this abuse and the fact that, unfortunately, the government of the state of New York and the city of New York and our local government, to some degree, is complicit in this destruction of a wonderful brownstone community.
And one of the happier byproducts of the financial crisis is that Bruce Ratner's had some trouble raising money for this project, right? What's
yes.
happening with his
Well, he has to go and sell these bonds by the end of the year, otherwise he'll lose his tax exempt status from the federal government. The bond market has downgraded his bonds. I don't know whether or not he'll be successful in selling them. I hope not. I do know that in my district, there were plans for a hotel, and the operators of that hotel called me yesterday and indicated to me that there was no appetite for bonds for a hotel, and I hope the same is true for an arena for the New Jersey Nets, who have an 18-0 loss and have unfortunately made history as being the worst team in the NBA.
As funny, I was just watching a clip of Marty Markowitz, the borough president, saying Brooklyn needs some world-class stuff. And I guess
I love Marty Markowitz. He's a cheerleader for Brooklyn, but we do not need a 20,000-seat arena. And this is not a world-class arena. They've downgraded the arena. It's a basic arena. Some have said it looks like a spaceship. Some have said it looks like a barn. Some have described it as a number of things, but all the bells and whistles are no longer associated with this arena. All of the star power is now removed. It's a basic arena. It'll basically turn Flatbush and Atlantic into a parking lot in an area where we already have poor air quality and where a significant number of the children unfortunately suffer from asthma, where you have seniors, where you have a significant amount of affordable housing, which is in jeopardy of being lost because of real estate speculators who are hoping that this project goes forward so that they can convert all of these homes in and around Fort Greene, Prospect Heights, and Clinton Hills to luxury housing, a playground for the rich, It will result in a significant amount of displacement, which has already happened, and instant gentrification. And that is why I oppose it for all those reasons.
And Dana Berliner, what Letitia James has been describing is certainly big news around New York. But New York is also known for having one of the most developer-friendly eminent domain laws in the country. But this is not an isolated instance. This is these kinds of uses of state power to promote the interests of private developers is pretty widespread around the United States, isn't it?
Absolutely. The abuse of eminent domain is a huge problem throughout the country. But many states have made major improvements, and New York now is truly the worst state in the entire country in terms of its total lack of protection for property owners from having their homes and businesses taken for private use. It has, as the New York Court of Appeals has said, there is going to be virtually no judicial protection from abuse. The decision today, I think, is a bright spot, but it's still going to be the exception and not the rule. The Court of Appeals said, basically, courts don't have to care. They don't have to look at anything. They don't have to look at the facts. They should just rubber stamp. Probably an occasional court won't do that, and that's great. But it means there's no real legal protection in New York. New York is one of only seven states that has not passed any legal reform since the Kelo decision.
Yeah, I want to get to the Kelo decision in a moment, but this show is also heard in California. So how does California stack up in the eminent domain follies?
Well, California is not good. It remains one of the worst, but it's still a little bit better than New York. For a couple of reasons. It has a little bit more judicial protection. Courts regularly will prevent abusive attempts to take property there. And it also did improve its laws a little bit recently. It didn't go nearly as far as it needs to, but it still has both more protection in the statutes and more protection from the courts than New York has.
All right, now the Kelo decision, you mentioned that. That was a very important New London decision, and tell us about that.
Well, in 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court held that under the United States Constitution, a project that claimed it would provide more jobs and taxes than the homes that were sitting there was a public use, because economic development, meaning jobs and taxes, is a public use under the U.S. Constitution. And all state constitutions, including New York's, require that the property be taken only for public use.
Now, that used to be fairly narrowly defined, right? And it's gotten broadly defined over the years?
Absolutely. I mean, that originally meant what you would think it means, property that's used by the public, like the police station or a public road. And now it means a private condo project. So that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said. It was a terrible decision, but it triggered a complete legal revolution in most states, but not New York.
Now, Pfizer has since, Pfizer, which was the beneficiary of the Kelo decision, has since decided to abandon the New London site anyway, right?
That's right. And many of these projects, I mean, Kelo, because it was the U.S. Supreme Court case, got a huge amount of publicity. Many of these projects fail. They're highly speculative, and real estate speculative projects sometimes fail. When that's a private project, nobody really notices. When it's something that somebody else's home was taken for, then it becomes a really big deal. So Pfizer pulled out. They never built anything on the land that was taken. It's a giant field with a bunch of cats and birds living on it now. They have no hope of building anything there. And then the Pfizer property on the adjacent land Pfizer is pulling out before its tax exemption expires. So they're getting nothing for all of the land they took and all of the money they spent.
Now, you said that this decision inspired a lot of reforms around the country. Tell us about some of those that happened.
Well, 43 states changed their laws after the decision, and most of those made really significant changes. Practically everyone said, we're not doing Kelo here, so you can't condemn for economic development in our state. In addition, they made the laws a lot tighter in all kinds of different ways to prevent the sort of freewheeling use of eminent domain for private projects that had been going on in virtually every state in the country. So that happened. The other thing that happened is that every state Supreme Court that heard a case about eminent domain engaged in much more serious judicial review and held that the use of eminent domain could not withstand that kind of review. So courts started ruling in favor of owners, and New York, the first court not to do that. So after Kelo, all of the state high courts started ruling in favor of owners, and New York's the first one to go the other way.
That is the voice of Dana Berliner of the Institute for Justice, who's been litigating eminent domain cases around the country, and Letitia James of New York City Council. What would it take, I mean, aside from the Atlantic Yards and the Columbia University struggles, I mean, what would it take to change the eminent domain regime in New York?
Well, first let's begin with the definition of blight, which is a subjective term. And the Court of Appeals has basically deferred to the state legislature to make that determination, and I believe that is incorrect. I believe that is wrong. You know, according to the a New York Times editorial, that it's, you know, big money rules in Albany, and that's why one needs to provide some sort of protections against this type of abuse. And so without some constitutional protection afforded against eminent domain abuse, you will continue to see this happen in New York State. And that's why there needs to be reform in all of the public authorities, which have the authority, again, to exercise eminent domain based upon their own interpretation of what is blighted. In Atlantic Yards, the Atlantic Yards footprint, the blight was created by the developer. It was developer-created blight. And it was when this project was announced and when Forest City Ratner started purchasing a property and basically going to homeowners and to business owners saying either you negotiate with us or we will exercise the right to take your property by force and with the help of the executive. And so that was the basis upon which the Court of Appeals held their hat. They deferred to the state legislature, and that should not be the case at all, particularly given what's happening in Albany. And what we need is a more objective definition of blight. In the Atlantic Yards footprint, you have co-ops and condos and townhouses and brownstones selling for $1 million plus. How can that possibly be blighted?
New York is unusual in having all these independent authorities, which have some state powers, which are kind of privately run, like the Empire Development Corporation, which is behind, which is Ratner's partner in all this.
Yes.
What's up with these authorities? Is anybody paying any attention to them, or are they completely opaque and accountable to nobody but themselves and their developer clients?
They're extremely opaque. They're quasi public private partnerships and authorities. They're created by the state legislature. They're created primarily to create debt for the state of New York because there's a prohibition against the legislature creating debt in the absence of some sort of referendum. And so what they did is backdoor borrowing through these public authorities, and they've created a significant amount of debt. In fact, the DASNY, the Dormitory Authority, created debt to build all these prisons. Which dot the throughway.
The Dormitory Authority, which is supposed to build college dormitories, is building prisons?
Prisons. They've built more prisons. In fact, they've built more prisons under the Cuomo administration than any other administration in the past. There was, I can remember when I first worked in Albany, there was a major protest in 1991 when I first arrived, and it was a protest that brought Albany to a halt in response to prison construction under the Cuomo administration. And they were all done not through voter approval, through referendums that were approved by the voters, but through backdoor borrowing by the dormitory authorities through DASNY. And this continues to happen again in the MTA, construction for our MTA system. Again, that's backdoor borrowing. And so, you know, there's a bill that's pending that has been put forth by the chairman of the Public Authorities and Corporations Committee, Assembly Member Brodsky, which seeks to reform public authorities. I believe it was passed, if I'm not mistaken. And the question is, does it go far enough in reforming public authorities and the issuance of debt, too? There's also another bill that's been put forth by Assemblymember Brodsky to amend the state statute as it relates to eminent domain, but that has not picked up any traction and has not moved forward. I don't know whether or not this bill is going to be put on the agenda for a debate, a discussion, and a vote, but it should be, given the abuse of eminent domain, not only in Brooklyn, but all throughout the state of New York.
And Dana Berliner, do other states have these authorities with the power to condemn, seize property, and subsidize developers?
Mostly not. Most states, there'll be city agencies. So there'll be a city, and then there'll be the city community development agency. But you don't have what you've got in New York of these state agencies that report to, I'm not even sure who, that are protected completely from the political process. That is a huge danger. And I want to also just totally agree with Letitia James that New York desperately, desperately needs legislative reform. It's got to change its eminent domain laws. They are absolutely terrible.
And it's clear that litigation holds not much promise for doing this now.
Not much. And litigation is never real protection because you've got to fight for 6 years to have it potentially protect you. And what people need for real security is overall legal change.
And sad to say, bringing the political spectrum to this conversation as we bring it to a close, but this has not been people on the left end of the spectrum have not paid much attention to this. It's been libertarians such as the Institute for Justice. Isn't that right?
Yeah. I disagree with that, actually. I mean, 43 states changed their laws. Those states varied in their political composition. And courts, other state high courts that had very politically divided justices, nonetheless were able to agree that eminent domain abuse needed to be stopped. I think New York has been totally unresponsive in this area, but on the whole, people on both the right and the left favor change in eminent domain. The polls show numbers like 90%, and if it's 90% of the people surveyed, you know it's not just one side of the spectrum. It's everyone.
Oh, Letitia James, you seemed more in agreement with my proposition.
Well, yeah, as I talk to a lot of my friends who serve in Albany and my friends in the city council, I put forth resolutions in support of reform, eminent domain reform, and I've picked up support from my Republican colleagues in the city council as opposed to some of my Democratic colleagues in the city council. And again, the fact that the bill that has been put forth and the debate as it relates to reforming our eminent domain statutes in the state of New York, in the state legislature, is not picking up any traction, is not picking up support from different groups who normally I would align myself with, including members of the Black and Latino caucus and some more progressive members of the state legislature. This is not a cause that they want to rally around because it has been used so much in terms of development in a number of cases in the city of New York, Willits Point, Columbia, Atlantic Yards, Coney Island. The list goes on and on and on.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for all the work you've done because it's great to have you as my city council person.
Oh, thank you.
I've been speaking with Letitia James, that last voice you heard, and before that, that of Dana Berliner, who is with the Institute for Justice in Virginia, both talking about eminent domain. Okay, and let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about job creation. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. And that's some of the piano sonata E-flat, number 52 by Joseph Haydn, performed by the first movement, performed by Alfred Brendel. We're now joined by Heidi Scherholz, who is with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and one of the authors of their proposed jobs program, the president convening a jobs summit at the White House, and mostly micro-initiatives emerging from that, it seems. But EPI has a bolder vision of how things might be done. Welcome to Behind the News, Heidi Scherholz.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, let's just get the dimensions of the job problem. People who listen to this program know I've been saying this for weeks and months. This is the worst recession since the 1930s in some sense. Maybe the post-World War II demobilization was a rival, but this has been one for the record books, at least for the last five or six decades. How bad is the employment situation now?
The crisis that we're in is, there's no other word to describe it but profound. You're right, it's the deepest thing we've seen in 70 years. And the one thing that sets it apart, aside from how severe it is how long it's likely to last before we get back to recovery. So the recession in sort of modern memory that approached this one in severity was the recession of the early 80s. We actually had an unemployment rate that was higher than what we have today.
Although not much now.
We're getting close, and now I think that there's probably no way we won't pass that eventually. But the thing is, once the macroeconomy, once GDP started growing again after the recession was over in the 80s, employment started flooding back. We got this very nice V shape. So the whole thing played out very quickly. The economy got relatively back on track pretty fast. That's not going to happen this time.
Well, the last two recessions, those the early 90s and early 2000s, we had jobless recoveries coming out of those. We had the return to GDP growth, but employment growth took another year or two really to kick in. It's likely we're going to see something like that again, even when the economy starts expanding meaningfully.
That's exactly right. It's going to take a long time before we see recovery on the ground. We have so many things pushing against a robust recovery. We're in the middle of the foreclosure crisis. State and local budgets are being crunched. We're still having a credit crunch. Consumers have really pulled back because they're poorer. There's all of the fundamentals really are still quite weak. And what that means is that we're not going to have that V. Employment isn't going to come flooding back.
And employers have shown a great reluctance to hire people. I mean, that's one of the things that distinguishes this recession. It's not so much the rate of job loss, but the hiring has just died.
That's exactly right. And the thing with that is that that is what marked the last two jobless recoveries. Layoffs moderated, as would be expected. And that's what's happening now. Layoffs are moderating very, like, right in line with what you would think with the improvements in the macroeconomy, but hiring is actually still declining. We're not seeing that other side of the equation pick up. And so we're never going to get job growth unless we see healthy jobs creation. That's the piece that's not there yet, and it's going to take a while, and that is why there's call for direct jobs creation now. We need a new strategy.
So you and your colleagues at the Economic Policy Institute have a plan. So tell us about that.
Yep. The plan is a 5-point plan. I can run through them very quickly.
Yeah, so we can just give us the five, and then we'll talk about each in detail.
Yeah, so the first one is extending and expanding the safety net provisions that were in the original Recovery Act. The second one is get aid to states and localities. States in particular have balanced budget requirements, so when their revenues fall during a recession, as they are right now, if the federal government doesn't step in and fill that in, they have no choice but to reduce spending or increase taxes, both of which drain the economy. We don't want to do either of those things right now. So we need to shore up state and local budgets. That's number two. Number three, additional infrastructure spending. There was some really good school modernization infrastructure stuff that was in the House version of the February Recovery Act that got stripped out. Let's do that now. That's number three. The fourth one is a direct jobs creation program. This really is a sort of baby WPA. Get actually have the government directly hire people. And then the fifth and final prong of our 5-point plan is a new jobs tax credit, which would be a business tax credit that would go towards businesses that were expanding employment, businesses that were hiring.
All right, let's talk about each of those in some detail then. Strengthening the safety net, you've got a couple of subheads under that that proposal. First of all, what's going on with unemployment insurance?
So the unemployment insurance, we've had unprecedented extensions of that, as is appropriate given the length of this recession, but they're set to expire in December. So we simply need to make sure that those don't expire, that unemployed workers aren't sort of left out to dry.
And we're really breaking records on duration of unemployment in this recession.
That is, as I said, we haven't reached the overall unemployment rate that we did in the recession of the early 80s yet. We are shattering every record related to lengths of unemployment spells. We have left every post-war recession in the dust as far as how long people are getting stuck in unemployment. And so extending unemployment insurance, it's a win-win in terms of it helps people who have been most hurt by the downturn, but it also is excellent macroeconomic policy, and the reason is unemployment insurance has this good, quote-unquote, multiplier effect. It has very good bang for the buck as far as stimulus goes. And the intuition there is that when you take somebody who's been unemployed for 6 months and give them an unemployment check, they have no choice but to spend that check immediately in their local economy on necessities. So it gets right back in. None of it is saved, and it has really good stimulative properties. So that's
so every dollar that's spent on unemployment insurance is spent several times over, right?
That's the idea. So it's important to just keep in mind that safety net spending, it not only provides relief, it also is a very good jobs creator through this re-spending effect.
We're also breaking records on food stamps now, right?
That's right. And the food stamps has been a really important program to families, where we are seeing huge increases in the number of families who are taking up food stamps. The one interesting thing there is that that's not set to expire. The food stamps provisions in the Recovery Act aren't expiring in December as some of the others are. So we don't have to immediately worry about extending those. The one thing is we could start to think more creatively about how we could expand nutrition assistance, because it's been a really important program, and we know it has really good bang for the buck. Spending on nutrition assistance goes directly into the economy. So if we could look at expanding that program, that's good for families and it's good for the macroeconomy.
Yeah, this will improve the lives of millions and millions of people, and at the same time, it'll give the economy a real boost. It's hard to argue with.
It is the win-win. The safety net, spending on the safety net is right. The phrase "hard to argue with" comes to mind.
although I'm sure we'll come to this later on, but I'm sure there are people who will argue very strenuously with this. All right, fiscal relief for state and local governments. That was already part of the so-called stimulus bill, the ARRA. Mm-hmm. People called it ARRA or just ARRA, I don't know. But you think we need to do some more?
Yeah, state and local budgets still have huge holes, and that's just it's almost a mechanical necessity for that, because if we don't fill in those holes because of their balanced budget requirements, they will be forced to take action that works against the recovery. So the fact that state and local budgets have such deep holes is a real threat to the economic recovery of the country.
And it also counter any efforts that Washington undertakes to stimulate the economy through very large stimulus spending are being counteracted by cutbacks to the state and local level.
Yeah, that's the way to think about it. When these state and local budget deficits, if they don't get filled in, it's as if you just subtract that amount from what we spent on the Recovery Act. It really is. I've heard people talk about it as you have 50 little Herbert Hoovers acting out there if we don't fill in their budget deficits.
I noticed in the EPI paper, which is available on your website, epi.org, on this, you quote Mark Zandi, the chief economist at economy.com, as saying that each dollar of budget relief provides nearly twice the economic stimulus as temporary tax cuts. And this guy advised John McCain during the campaign, so he is not a Democratic shill by any means.
Right, and it really does speak to there is a consensus, a pretty strong consensus across the board on the sort of hierarchy of stimulus spending. What kinds of spending has the best bang for the buck, so to speak? And this McCain advisor Mark Zandi is one of the people that are really relied on for their estimates of these bang for the buck estimates of stimulus effectiveness. And that's right. State and local fiscal relief is really high up there in terms of how much good you get for each dollar you spend on it.
And again, this is one of those things that is good for the economy but also good for people, because state and local governments provide services that matter in people's day-to-day lives.
Right. And so we will keep it's that threefold thing. We will keep the jobs of firefighters and teachers. We won't have to cut services that families rely on. And then everyone who kept their jobs in those scenarios will be able to spend their jobs in their state's economy, and we get that nice multiplier re-spending effect.
And so far, the federal assistance to the states are only a fix about a quarter of the problem. Still, we have three quarters remaining, right?
Yeah, the holes that states are facing, and this happens at the national level too, since are just larger than anyone expected. When the February stimulus package was being designed, at that time, we were losing around 700,000 jobs a month. That's what we were losing in the first quarter of this year. And then since then, we've lost 2.6 million jobs. The erosion in the economy is just much more profound than anyone expected. So the drop in revenues that state governments, local governments, and the national government are facing are much more profound than expected.
So you're advocating a big injection to the state and local governments, which, by your estimates, will save between 1 million and 1.5 million jobs.
Right. That's right.
Okay, then. Now we'll move on to some more familiar territory for economic stimulus schemes, which is infrastructure spending, transportation, and schools. You highlight. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. So infrastructure spending also is one of those kinds of stimulus spending you can do that has a really nice multiplier effect. It's a really good bang for the buck. But one of the problems is we want to make sure we do things that are this quote-unquote shovel-ready that can get out there quickly. A lot of that stuff was already in the first stimulus package. And so you have to kind of look around to see what can you do quickly. There's low-hanging fruit there with the school modernization spending, because it was already in the House version of the Stimulus Act. It was already vetted to be shovel-ready, ready to go, but then it was stripped out of the final bill.
So we have a lot of older schools that are just falling apart. This is not just make-work nonsense.
That's right. The schools that have not been repaired, have not been kept, up to modern standards. There is a lot to be done there to make our schools safe and workable for our kids, and this is the time to do it.
Speaking of Heidi Scherholz with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, who is one of the authors of their American Jobs Plan, which you can get in full on their website, epi.org. Now, there has been a feminist critique of a lot of this infrastructure spending, and it provides jobs for men, and that more squishy, crunchy things like daycare and home health care and that sort of thing always takes a back seat, but that would provide jobs for women. What do you think of that kind of critique?
It's interesting, and we have to keep in mind the different sort of demographic impact of these different kinds of spending. But one thing that is true about this recession is everyone is getting hit hard. Everyone is seeing big increases in unemployment, but men are seeing bigger increases in unemployment in this recession. And that's due largely to their concentration in manufacturing and construction. So if we get some of those kinds of jobs back, it will just simply be, sort of restoring things to where they were to some extent. So that's not actually a problem in my eyes. The other important thing to keep in mind is that the original recovery package, similar to the jobs plan that we're putting out, they're not infrastructure programs. The infrastructure in the original Recovery Act was approximately 15% of the total spending. So it was a chunk of it. And because of that, there will be somewhat disproportionate job creation in construction and manufacturing. It wasn't by any means an infrastructure plan. It was a larger stimulus plan, and infrastructure was a small part of it, a relatively small part of it.
I myself just looked at some of the state-by-state composition of job loss and found that 45% of the job losses in this recession have been accounted for by just seven states, the four states that usually identify as the epicenters of the housing bubble, California, mm-hmm. Florida, Nevada, and Arizona, and the three states of the industrial Midwest, Michigan, Ohio, and Illinois. Those states alone have produced almost half of the job loss. So spending on manufacturing and construction would address these problems very directly.
Mm-hmm. That's right. If we can really get some of those jobs back in manufacturing, that would help the places that have been hit the hardest by this.
And
so that's a good thing.
You're also proposing a large public jobs program, which is a rather unfashionable thing to talk about these days.
That's right. But you know what? As in this town in Washington, I see it becoming more and more fashionable. In February, I heard the administration say, a dozen times, if I heard them once, say, the February recovery package, it's not the government hiring people directly. Less than 10% of the jobs from that package were going to be less than 10% of the jobs created would be government jobs. There was a lot of emphasis on how that package was going to be creating private jobs. That was how it was sold. Now, there's been a shift. People are realizing, with just how profound the crisis is in the labor market, that we need to start hiring people. There has been a shift towards an acceptance of maybe now it's time to really do this directly.
Yeah, if you go to recovery.gov, the government website devoted to this, you will discover that if you divide the amount of money they've spent by the number of jobs they claim have been created, it comes to about $250,000 a job, which is not very efficient use of public funds.
So part of the issue with that is there are numbers that have been directly reported as being created or saved by the stimulus spending only captures a portion of those that have actually been created or saved, because this is the thing. When it only, for example, consider state funding. It will count those teachers' jobs and firefighters' jobs that have been saved, or the road workers' jobs that have been saved or created. But what it doesn't count is, say, the cement workers' job that got saved because their company got a cement contract to build that road. So it doesn't count those indirect jobs. And then it also doesn't count those, quote-unquote, re-spending jobs, which are because all of those other workers kept their jobs. The restaurant worker, where they went to eat lunch, also got to keep their job because that restaurant didn't see a fall off in demand for their food. And so the the numbers that you see on what's been created by the stimulus package can be misleadingly small.
But even if you adjust that, you're still getting, this is still a very expensive mode of job creation. You know, if it's not $250,000, it's $175,000 a job, we're still, you could do it much more effectively by just hiring people.
That's right. That's right. And all the estimates on how money per job, it's a lot more efficient if you just directly hire people. And then it becomes a question of how do we do it administratively? And our thought on that is that you get money directly to localities. Those localities get to decide how best to spend that money, what projects they need in their area, and then you put some strings to that money. You make sure that, say, 80% of the money that they get must go towards wages or benefits.
We're just about out of time. I'm sorry to have to get out here a little early today, but you want to pay for all this in part with a transactions tax on financial trading, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So the idea with a financial transactions tax, or you also hear it called a Wall Street sales tax, it's very similar to the sales tax you pay on clothes or appliances or whatever. Those sales taxes are often on the order of 5% of the total price of the good. The financial transactions tax that we are proposing is about a tenth of that. It'd be a 0.5% transactions tax whenever a good, say, a stock is bought or sold. But because that happens all the time, that would actually generate a lot of money. But importantly, the burden of that tax would not fall on people who buy an asset and keep it for a very long time. It would fall much more heavily on people who speculate. So it can actually help rein in some of the very activities that got us into this mess in the first place. So it can actually be both a revenue creator, and it can actually make our system more efficient by making these risky speculations more costly.
That would improve public morals. Thank you for joining us, Heidi Shierholz. I just have to cut it off mercilessly here.
No problem.
Heidi Shierholz is with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, and if you want to read up more on their jobs creation program, you can visit epi.org on the web. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week, and let's go out with this some new music from the great band Sleepyhead. This is called Red Letter Days. Till next week, bye.